Chapter 13. Performance Appraisal. Manager as Judge and Jury. Why bother? Why are performance reviews a part of the management system of most organizations? And why do we review the performance of our subordinates? I posed both questions to a group of middle managers and got the following responses: to assess the subordinates' work, to improve performance, to motivate, to provide feedback to a subordinate, to justify raises, to reward performance, to provide discipline, to provide work direction, to reinforce the company culture. Next, I asked the group to imagine themselves to be a supervisor giving a review to a subordinate and asked them what their feelings were. Some of the answers: pride, anger, anxiety, discomfort, guilt, empathy or concern, embarrassment, frustration. Finally, I asked the same group to think back to some of the performance reviews they had received and asked what, if anything, was wrong with them. Their answers were quick and many. Review comments too general. Mixed messages, inconsistent with rating or dollar raise. No indication of how to improve. Negatives avoided. Supervisor didn't know my work. Only recent performance considered. Surprises. This should tell you that giving performance reviews is a very complicated and difficult business, and that we, managers, don't do an especially good job at it. The fact is that giving such reviews is the single most important form of task-relevant feedback we as supervisors can provide. It is how we assess our subordinates' level of performance and how we deliver that assessment to them individually. It is also how we allocate the rewards, promotions, dollars, stock options, or whatever we may use. As we saw earlier, the review will influence a subordinate's performance, positively or negatively, for a long time, which makes the appraisal one of the manager's highest leverage activities. In short, the review is an extremely powerful mechanism, and it is little wonder that opinions and feelings about it are strong and diverse. But what is its fundamental purpose? Though all of the responses given to my questions are correct, there is one that is more important than any of the others. It is to improve the subordinate's performance. The review is usually dedicated to two things. First, the skill level of the subordinate, to determine what skills are missing and to find ways to remedy that lack. And second, to intensify the subordinate's motivation in order to get him on a higher performance curve for the same skill level. The review process also represents the most formal type of institutionalized leadership. It is the only time a manager is mandated to act as judge and jury. We managers are required by the organization that employs us to make a judgment regarding a fellow worker and then to deliver that judgment to him, face to face. A supervisor's responsibility here is obviously very significant. What preparation have we had to do the job properly? About the only thing I can think of is that as subordinates, we've been on the receiving end. But in general, our society values avoiding confrontation. Even the word argument is frowned upon, something I learned many years ago when I first came to this country from Hungary. In Hungarian, the word argument is frequently used to describe a difference of opinion. When I began to learn English and used the word argument, I would be corrected, as people would say, "Oh no, you don't mean argument, you mean debate, or you mean discussion." Among friends and peers, you are not supposed to discuss politics, religion, or anything that might possibly produce a difference of opinion and a conflict. Football scores, gardening, and the weather are okay. We are taught that the well-mannered skirt potentially emotional issues. The point is, delivering a good performance review is really a unique act given both our cultural background and our professional training. Don't think for a moment that performance reviews should be confined to large organizations. They should be part of managerial practice in organizations of any size and kind. From the insurance agent with two office assistants, to administrators in education, government, and nonprofit organizations. The long and short of it, if performance matters in your operation, performance reviews are absolutely necessary. Two aspects of the review, assessing performance and delivering the assessment, are equally difficult. Let's look at each in a little more detail. Assessing performance. Determining the performance of professional employees in a strictly objective manner is very difficult because there is obviously no cut and dried way to measure and characterize a professional employee's work completely. Most jobs involve activities that are not reflected by output in the time period covered by the review. Yet we have to give such activities appropriate weight as we assess a person's performance, even though we know we won't necessarily be objective, since only output can be measured with true objectivity. Anybody who supervises professionals, therefore, walks a tightrope. He needs to be objective, but must not be afraid of using his judgment, even though judgment is, by definition, subjective. To make an assessment less difficult, a supervisor should clarify in his own mind in advance what it is that he expects from a subordinate, and then attempt to judge whether he performed to expectations. The biggest problem with most reviews is that we don't usually define what it is we want from our subordinates. And as noted earlier, if we don't know what we want, we are surely not going to get it. Let's think back to our concept of the managerial black box. Using it, we can characterize performance by output measures and internal measures. The first represent the output of the black box and include such things as completing designs, meeting sales quotas, or increasing the yield in a production process, things we can and should plot on charts. The internal measures take into account activities that go on inside the black box. Whatever is being done to create output for the period under review, and also that which sets the stage for the output of future periods. Are we reaching our current production goals in such a way that 2 months from now we are likely to face a group of disgruntled production employees? Are we positioning and developing people in the organization in such a way that our business can handle its tasks in the future? Are we doing all of the things that add up to a well-run department? There is no strict formula by which we can compare the relative significance of output measures and internal measures. In a given situation, the proper weighting could be 50-50, 90-10, or 10-90, and could even shift from 1 month to the next. But at least we should know which two variables are being traded off against each other. A similar kind of trade-off also has to be considered here, weighing long-term-oriented against short-term-oriented performance. An engineer working on the design of a product needs to complete the project on a strict schedule to generate revenue. He may also be working on a design method that will make it easier for others to design similar products in the future. The engineer obviously needs both activities evaluated and reviewed. Which is more significant? A way to help weigh questions like this is the idea of present value used in finance. How much will the future-oriented activity pay back over time? And how much is that worth today? There is also a time factor to consider. The subordinate's output during the review period may have all, some, or nothing to do with his activities during the same period. Accordingly, the supervisor should look at the time offset between the activity of the subordinate and the output that results from that activity. Let me explain what I mean, because this is one lesson I learned the hard way. The organization of one of the managers reporting to me had had a superb year. All output measures were excellent, sales increased, profit margins were good, the products worked, you could hardly even think of giving anything but a superior review to the person in charge. Yet, I had some misgivings. Turnover in his group was higher than it should have been, and his people were grumbling too much. There were other such straws in the wind, but who could give credence to elusive signs when tangible, measurable performance was so outstanding? So, the manager got a very positive review. The next year, his organization took a nosedive. Sales growth disappeared, profitability declined, product development was delayed, and the turmoil among his subordinates deepened. As I prepared the next review of this manager, I struggled to sort out what had happened. Did the manager's performance deteriorate as suddenly as his organization's output measures indicated? What was going on? I concluded that, in fact, the manager's performance was improving in the second year, even as things seemed to go to hell. The problem was that his performance had not been good a year earlier. The output indicators merely represented work done years ago, the light from distant stars, as it were, which was still holding up. The time offset between the manager's work and the output of his organization was just about a year. Greatly embarrassed, I regretfully concluded that the superior rating I had given him was totally wrong. Trusting the internal measures, I should have had the judgment and courage to give the manager a much lower rating than I did in spite of the excellent output indicators that did not reflect the year under review. The time offset between activity and output can also work the other way around. In the early years of Intel, I was called upon to review the performance of a subordinate who was setting up a production facility from scratch. It had not manufactured anything as yet, but of course the review could not wait for tangible output. I had had no prior experience supervising someone who did not have a record of concrete output. Here, I gave my subordinate credit for doing well, even though output remained uncertain. As managers, we are really called upon to judge performance, not just to see and record it when it's in plain sight. Finally, as you review a manager, should you be judging his performance or the performance of the group under his supervision? You should be doing both. Ultimately, what you are after is the performance of the group, but the manager is there to add value in some way. You need to determine what that is. You must ask, is he doing anything with his group? Is he hiring new people? Is he training the people he has and doing other things that are likely to improve the output of the team in the future? The most difficult issues in determining a professional's performance will be based on asking questions and making judgments of this sort. One big pitfall to be avoided is the potential trap. At all times, you should force yourself to assess performance, not potential. By potential, I mean form rather than substance. I was once asked to approve the performance review of a general manager whose supervisor rated him highly for the year. The manager was responsible for a business unit that lost money, missed its revenue forecast month after month, slipped engineering schedules, and in general showed poor output and internal measures over the year. Accordingly, I could not approve the review. Whereupon his supervisor said, "But he is an outstanding general manager. He is knowledgeable and handles himself well. It's his organization that did not do well, not the manager himself." This cut no ice with me, because the performance rating of a manager cannot be higher than the one we would accord to his organization. It is very important to assess actual performance, not appearances, real output, not good form. Had the manager been given a high rating, Intel would have signaled to all at the company that to do well, you must act like a good manager, talk like one, and emulate one. But you don't need to perform like one. A decision to promote is often linked, as it should be, to the performance review. We must recognize that no action communicates a manager's values to an organization more clearly and loudly than his choice of whom he promotes. By elevating someone, we are, in effect, creating role models for others in our organization. The old saying has it that when we promote our best salesman and make him a manager, we ruin a good salesman and get a bad manager. But if we think about it, we see we have no choice but to promote the good salesman. Should our worst salesman get the job? When we promote our best, we are saying to our subordinates that performance is what counts. It is hard enough for us to assess our subordinates' performance, but we must also try to improve it. No matter how well a subordinate has done his job, we can always find ways to suggest improvement, something about which a manager need not feel embarrassed. Blessed with 20/20 hindsight, we can compare what the subordinate did against what he might have done, and the variance can tell both of us how to do things better in the future. Delivering the assessment. There are three L's to keep in mind when delivering a review: level, listen, and leave yourself out. You must level with your subordinate. The credibility and integrity of the entire system depend on your being totally frank. And don't be surprised to find that praising someone in a straightforward fashion can be just as hard as criticizing him without embarrassment. The word listen has special meaning here. The aim of communication is to transmit thoughts from the brain of person A to the brain of person B. Thoughts in the head of A are first converted into words, which are enunciated and via sound waves reach the ear of B. As nerve impulses, they travel to his brain, where they are transformed back into thoughts and presumably kept. Should person A use a tape recorder to confirm the words used in the review? The answer is an emphatic no. Words themselves are nothing but a means. Getting the right thought communicated is the end. Perhaps B has become so emotional that he can't understand something that would be perfectly clear to anyone else. Perhaps B has become so preoccupied trying to formulate answers that he can't really listen and get A's message. Perhaps B is tuned out and, as a defense, is thinking of going fishing. All of these possibilities can and do occur, and all the more so when A's message is laden with conflict. How, then, can you be sure you are being truly heard? What techniques can you employ? Is it enough to have your subordinate paraphrase your words? I don't think so. What you must do is employ all of your sensory capabilities. To make sure you're being heard, you should watch the person you are talking to. Remember, the more complex the issue, the more prone communication is to being lost. Does your subordinate give appropriate responses to what you are saying? Does he allow himself to receive your message? If his responses, verbal and nonverbal, do not completely assure you that what you've said has gotten through, it is your responsibility to keep at it until you are satisfied that you have been heard and understood. This is what I mean by listening. Employing your entire arsenal of sensory capabilities to make certain your points are being properly interpreted by your subordinate's brain. All the intelligence and good faith used to prepare your review will produce nothing unless this occurs. Your tool, to say it again, is total listening. Every good classroom teacher works in the same way. He knows when what he is saying is being understood by his students. If it isn't, he takes heed and explains things again or explains things in a different way. All of us have had professors who lectured by looking at the blackboard, mumbling to it, and carefully avoiding direct eye contact with the class. The reason? Knowing that their presentation was murky and incomprehensible, these teachers looked away from their audience to avoid confirming visually what they already knew. So don't imitate your worst professors while delivering performance reviews. Listen with all your might to make sure your subordinate is receiving your message. and don't stop delivering it until you are satisfied that he is. The third L is leave yourself out. It is very important for you to understand that the performance review is about and for your subordinate. So your own insecurities, anxieties, guilt, or whatever should be kept out of it. At issue are the subordinate's problems, not the supervisor's, and it is the subordinate's day in court. Anyone called upon to assess the performance of another person is likely to have strong emotions before and during the review, just as actors have stage fright. You should work to control these emotions so that they don't affect your task, though they will well up no matter how many reviews you've given. Let us now consider three types of performance reviews. On the one hand, on the other hand. Most reviews probably fall into this category, containing both positive and negative assessments. Common problems here include superficiality, cliches, and laundry lists of unrelated observations. All of these will leave your subordinate bewildered and will hardly improve his future performance, the review's basic purpose. Let me suggest some ways to help you deliver this type of review. The key is to recognize that your subordinate, like most people, has only a finite capacity to deal with facts, issues, and suggestions. You may possess 7 truths about his performance, but if his capacity is only 4, at best you'll waste your breath on the other 3. At worst, you will have left him with a case of sensory overload, and he will go away without getting anything out of the review. The fact is that a person can only absorb so many messages at one time, especially when they deal with his own performance. The purpose of the review is not to cleanse your system of all the truths you may have observed about your subordinate, but to improve his performance. So here, less may very well be more. How can you target a few key areas? First, consider as many aspects of your subordinate's performance as possible. You should scan materials such as progress reports, performance against quarterly objectives, and one-on-one meeting notes. Then, sit down with a blank piece of paper. As you consider your subordinate's performance, write everything down on the paper. Do not edit in your head. Get everything down, knowing that doing so doesn't commit you to do anything. Things major, minor, and trivial can be included in no particular order. When you have run out of items, you can put all of your supporting documentation away. Now, from your worksheet, look for relationships between the various items listed. You will probably begin to notice that certain items are different manifestations of the same phenomenon, and that there may be some indications why a certain strength or weakness exists. When you find such relationships, you can start calling them messages for the subordinate. You can see an example worksheet for performance review in the PDF. Now, again from your worksheet, begin to draw conclusions and specific examples to support them. Once your list of messages has been compiled, ask yourself if your subordinate will be able to remember all of the messages you have chosen to deliver. If not, you must delete the less important ones. Remember, what you couldn't include in this review, you can probably take up in the next one. Let's talk about surprises. If you have discharged your supervisory responsibilities adequately throughout the year, holding regular one-on-one meetings and providing guidance when needed, there should never be any surprises at a performance review, right? Wrong. When you are using the worksheet, sometimes you come up with a message that will startle you. So what do you do? You're faced with either delivering the message or not. But if the purpose of the review is to improve your subordinate's performance, you must deliver it. Preferably, a review should not contain any surprises. But if you uncover one, swallow hard and bring it up. In the PDF, you'll find an on the one hand, on the other hand kind of performance review. It was written to correspond to the worksheet. I have annotated it to call attention to some of the things we discussed in this chapter. The blast. With a little soul searching, you may come to realize that you have a major performance problem on your hands. You have a subordinate who, unless turned around, could get fired. To deal with the problem, you and your subordinate will likely go through stages commonly experienced in problem solving of all kinds, and particularly in conflict resolution. The stages of problem solving. The transition from blaming others to assuming responsibility is an emotional step. Ignore, deny, blame others, assume responsibility, find solution. You'll find these occurring definitely during and possibly after the blast review, which is basically an exercise of resolving conflict about a big performance problem. A poor performer has a strong tendency to ignore his problem. Here, a manager needs facts and examples so that he can demonstrate its reality. Progress of some sort is made when the subordinate actively denies the existence of a problem rather than ignoring it passively, as before. Evidence can overcome resistance here as well. And we enter the third stage, when the subordinate admits that there is a problem but maintains it is not his problem. Instead, he will blame others, a standard defense mechanism. Using this defense, he can continue to avoid the responsibility and burden of remedying the situation. These three steps usually follow one another in fairly rapid succession, but things tend to get stuck at the blame others stage. If your subordinate does have a problem, there's no way of resolving it if he continues to blame it on others. He has to take the biggest step, namely, assuming responsibility. He has to say not only that there is a problem, but that it is his problem. This is fateful, because it means work. If it is my problem, I have to do something about it. If I have to do something, it is likely to be unpleasant and will definitely mean a lot of work on my part. Once responsibility has been assumed, however, finding the solution is relatively easy. This is because the move from blaming others to assuming responsibility constitutes an emotional step, while the move from assuming responsibility to finding the solution is an intellectual one, and the latter is easier. It is the reviewer's job to get the subordinate to move through all of the stages to that of assuming responsibility, though finding the solution should be a shared task. The supervisor should keep track of what stage things are in. If the supervisor wants to go on to find the solution when the subordinate is still denying or blaming others, nothing can happen. Knowing where you are will help you both move through the stages together. In the end, there are three possible outcomes. One, the subordinate accepts your assessment and your recommended cure and commits himself to take it. Two, he may disagree completely with your assessment, but still accept your cure. Three, the subordinate disagrees with your assessment and does not commit himself to do what you've recommended. As the supervisor, which of these three should you consider acceptable resolutions to the problem? I feel very strongly that any outcome that includes a commitment to action is acceptable. Complex issues do not lend themselves easily to universal agreement. If your subordinate says he's committed to change things, you have to assume he's sincere. The key word here is acceptable. It is certainly more desirable for you and your subordinate to agree about the problem and the solution because that will make you feel that he will enthusiastically work toward remedying it. So up to a point, you should try to get your subordinate to agree with you. But if you can't, accept his commitment to change and go on. Don't confuse emotional comfort with operational need. To make things work, people do not need to side with you. You only need them to commit themselves to pursue a course of action that has been decided upon. There seems to be something not quite nice about expecting a person to walk down a path he'd rather not be on. But on the job, we are after a person's performance, not our psychological comfort. I learned the distinction between the two during one of the first reviews I had to give. I was trying very hard to persuade my subordinate to see things my way. He simply would not go along with me, and finally said to me, "Andy, you will never convince me. But why do you insist on wanting to convince me? I've already said I will do what you say." I shut up, embarrassed, not knowing why. It took me a long time before I realized I was embarrassed because my insistence had a lot to do with making me feel better and little to do with the running of the business. If it becomes clear that you are not going to get your subordinate past the blame other stage, you will have to assume the formal role of the supervisor, endowed with position power, and say, "This is what I, as your boss, am instructing you to do. I understand that you do not see it my way. You may be right, or I may be right. But I am not only empowered, I am required by the organization for which we both work to give you instructions, and this is what I want you to do." And proceed to secure your subordinate's commitment to the course of action you want, and thereafter monitor his performance against that commitment. Recently, one of my subordinates wrote a review that I considered superficial, lacking analysis, and depth. My subordinate, after some discussion, agreed with my assessment, but he considered the issue not important enough, as he put it, to spend time rewriting the review. After more spirited discussion, we remained deadlocked. Finally, I took a deep breath and said to him, "Look, I understand that you don't consider it worth your time to do it, but I want you to do it." I added that I guess there is a basic difference between us. The integrity of the performance review system is just more important to me than it is to you. That is why I have to insist. He looked back at me, and after a moment simply said, "Okay." He thought I was out in left field, and resented the fact that I made him spend time on something he thought was unimportant. But he committed himself to redo the review, and in fact, he did it well. His subordinate ended up getting the reworked, much more thorough and thoughtful review. And the fact that his review was rewritten without the agreement of my subordinate made no difference to him. Reviewing the ACE. After trying to establish the principles of performance appraisal with a group of about 20 middle managers, I asked them to take a review they had once received and to analyze it according to our new criteria. The results were not what I expected, but I did learn from them. This group consisted of achievers, and their ratings were mostly very high. The reviews were exceptionally well written, much better than the average at Intel. However, for content, they tended to be retrospective assessments, analyses of what the subordinate had done in the course of the prior year. Even though their key purpose was to improve the subordinate's future performance, a majority of the reviews made little or no attempt to define what the subordinate needed to do to improve his performance or even to maintain his current level. It seems that for an achiever, the supervisor's effort goes into determining and justifying the judgment of the superior performance, while giving little attention to how he could do even better. But for a poor performer, the supervisor tends to concentrate heavily on ways he can improve performance, providing detailed and elaborate corrective action programs, step-by-step affairs meant to ensure that the marginal employee can pull himself up to meet minimum requirements. I think we have our priorities reversed. Shouldn't we spend more time trying to improve the performance of our stars? After all, these people account for a disproportionately large share of the work in any organization. Put another way, concentrating on the stars is a high leverage activity. If they get better, the impact on group output is very great indeed. We all have a hard time saying things that are critical, whether we're talking to a superior employee or a marginal one. We must keep in mind, however, that no matter how stellar a person's performance level is, there is always room for improvement. Don't hesitate to use the 2020 hindsight provided by the review to show anyone, even an ace, how he might have done better. Other thoughts and practices. Is it a good idea to ask the subordinate to prepare some kind of a self-review before being reviewed by his supervisor? Let me answer the question this way. Your own review is obviously important to you, and you really want to know how your supervisor sees your year's work. If you prepare a review and give it to your supervisor, and he simply changes the format, retypes it, gives you a superior rating, and then hands it back to you, how will you feel? Probably cheated. If you have to tell your supervisor about your accomplishments, he obviously doesn't pay much attention to what you are doing. Reviewing the performance of subordinates is a formal act of leadership. If supervisors permit themselves to be prompted in one way or another, their leadership and their capacity for it will begin to appear false. So the integrity of the supervisor's judgment here must be preserved at all costs, and they must commit themselves through an upfront judgment of their subordinate's performance if the health and vitality of the review process are to be maintained. What about asking your subordinate to evaluate your performance as his supervisor? I think this might be a good idea. But you should make it clear to your subordinate that it's your job to assess his performance, while his assessment of you has only advisory status. The point is, he is not your leader. You are his. And under no circumstances should you pretend that you and your subordinates are equal during performance reviews. Should you deliver the written review before, during, or after the face-to-face discussion? I have tried it all three ways. Let's consider some of the pros and cons of each. What happens if you have the review first and then give your subordinate what you've written later? Upon reading it, the subordinate may find a phrase that he didn't hear earlier and blow up over it. What about delivering the written review during the discussion? One manager told me that he gives the subordinate a copy of the review and tells him to read the first several paragraphs, which they then discuss. Grouping the paragraphs, supervisor and subordinate work their way through the appraisal. I can see a problem with this. How can a supervisor ask a subordinate to stop at paragraph 3 when he is so eager to read the rest of what he's got? Another manager told me that he reads the written review to his subordinate to try to control the session. But here too, the subordinate is left eager to know what comes next and might not pay attention to what is really being said. Also, when your subordinate is given a written review during the discussion, he won't have the time to think about what it says and is likely to walk away muttering to himself, "I should have said this in response, and I should have said that." For a good meeting of minds, your subordinate should have time to work out his reactions to what's in the review. In my experience, the best thing to do is to give your subordinate the written review sometime before the face-to-face discussion. He can then read the whole thing privately and digest it. He can react or overreact and then look at the messages again. By the time the two of you get together, he will be much more prepared, both emotionally and rationally. Preparing and delivering a performance assessment is one of the hardest tasks you'll have to perform as a manager. The best way to learn how to do one is to think critically about the reviews you yourself have received. And if you've been lucky, the tradition of good performance reviews has been handed from supervisor to subordinate, which has helped to maintain the integrity of the system in your company. Nevertheless, people constantly need to be prodded into doing a good job of reviewing. Each year, I read something like 100 evaluations, all of those written by my own subordinates, and a random selection from throughout Intel. I comment on them and send them back for rewrites or with a complimentary note. I do this with as much noise and visibility as I can, because I want to reiterate and reaffirm the significance the system has and should have for every Intel employee. Anything less would not be appropriate for the most important kind of task-relevant feedback we can give our subordinates.